And we are on the air and you are listening to the Hallie Kesser Jane Show. Let's talk. And I am Hallie Kesser Jane. Welcome to my listeners in the United States and around the world. Tune into the Hallie Kesser Jane Show at HallieKesserJane.com. Today on the Hallie Kesser Jane Show, we take a trip to Russia and a sailing trip around the world. When joining me at my table is Lisa Dickey, the author of Bears in the Streets, an eye-opening memoir of Dickey's travels over a 20-year span throughout Russia. And I speak with Jeremy Cage, entrepreneur, former Fortune 100 executive, and president of the Cage Group, who had a dream to sail around the world and did. He shares his story and what he learned in his life's adventures in his book, All Dreams on Deck. What do the Russian people think about Americans? What do they think about Vladimir Putin? A primer on helping you realize your dreams today on the Hallie Kesser Jane Show. Let's get to it. We begin with Lisa Dickey. In the fall of 1995, the author and ghostwriter, whose talent has contributed to 8 New York Times bestsellers, Lisa Dickey traveled across the whole of Russia, interviewing people from all walks of life in 11 different cities. In 2005, she made the entire trip again, interviewing all the same people to find out how their lives had changed. 10 years later, in 2015, she made the trip yet again, interviewing the same people she had met 20 years earlier. Her goal? To find out how life in Russia had changed in the ensuing years. Her new book, Bears in the Streets, 3 Journeys Across a Changing Russia, tells Lisa's story and chronicles the changing lives of Russians in the ever-changing Russian political climate. Let's talk. Lisa, could Bears in the Streets be any more timely? I mean, are you kidding? How lucky are you, girlfriend? Putin, Trump, Russia, back in America's consciousness. You've got to be thanking Donald Trump and saying, thank you, my book's well.
Yeah, silver lining, right? Silver lining, the one.
What do you think? You think that's true? I mean, this is just really a great read. I was just telling Lisa off air that I actually read this one because sometimes I didn't get it all the way through, but this was delicious. Your fascination with Russia, let's start there. How did that start?
So it started back in the 70s when I was 9 years old. My dad was in the U.S. Navy. And so, you know, at that point, the Cold War was on. And I understood as, you know, a 9-year-old, very simplistically, that, you know, Russia was our enemies and dad was fighting them. And so, you know, I understood that. And then the year that I was 9, my mom decided, this was 1976, that she was going to go on a tour of the Soviet Union. So she went on this like organized tour to Moscow, Leningrad, and Kiev. And it just blew my 9-year-old mind. I thought, I don't understand how this is possible, how on the one hand, my dad is fighting them and my mom wants to go have vacation with them. That just seemed nuts to me. So she goes and I'm thinking, oh my God, will I ever see my mother again? What kind of terrible things might happen to her? And when she came back 10 days later, she said, it was lovely. The people were really wonderful to us. There was just so much history and it was beautiful. And I think just at that time, it just really stuck in my head as, wow, I really want to understand how both of these things can be true.
So your first trip, you finally go. You're how old when you went the first time?
I was 20 when I first set foot in Russia. This was during the Soviet era. It was 1988. It was my first job out of college, was working as a nanny for a U.S. diplomatic family that was stationed at the U.S. Embassy in Moscow. And I arrived, I was 20, and that week I turned 21. And it was this fantastic thing where I went walking through Red Square for the very first time on my 21st birthday, and I thought, oh my God, this is the most magical thing ever.
Magical, interesting word. Not one I would put with Russia.
But being
a person who also did some of the what crazy that you did and went to weird places that people aren't supposed to go to, particularly when they're young in their 20s, I can understand the magical. Your first impression?
So my first impression, you know, this was during the Soviet era. And it was, you know, Moscow was a very sort of gray and stately and huge place, very intimidating in a lot of ways. And, you know, during the Soviet era, you'd walk down the street and all the doors had names like milk and bread and fish. And it was nothing like the Moscow of today, where it's a bustling, feels like a big capital city. So my impression was just, you know, there's so much history there. There were amazing museums, but it was really very much a Soviet era thing where it was kind of gray. People were frustrated. You know, it was the tail end of the Soviet Union. And it was a fascinating place to be.
So before we go further, interesting, gray, because that's all that I ever think. I'm half Russian. I'm sitting here right now looking at my great-great-grandfather in the Russian Revolution in the whatever. And I'm thinking, and I didn't know him, of course, but it was, you know, that picture. I remember when my Russian relatives got together, big boisterous party, yada, yada, yada. But on the other hand, there was a certain darkness to all of that. And you and I grew up, you know, in an era when that's our picture. It's black and white.
Yes.
Maybe with a little red in the Kremlin. But basically, well, black and white. And talk about that picture.
I mean, I think, you know, one of the things that's interesting is that, you know, I think that to a certain extent, you know, most Americans think this about Russia, that it is a dark and sort of dour place and people don't seem very happy and it's very gray. And it's understandable why that is the prevailing notion. I mean, you know, they were our enemies for so long, and everything in pop culture in the 70s and 80s when I was growing up was the Russians were the bad guys. It's also true that Russians are not particularly friendly if you just encounter them on the street. If you're walking down a street in, you know, any Russian town or city, people are not smiling and saying hello and, you know, greeting each other. And so it's not surprising that people would have that impression. But one of the things that I have found in spending a lot of time with Russians in their homes and getting to know them is, you know, once you have some sort of connection, even if it's just a really tenuous one, like, oh, my brother's sister's aunt's teacher, you know, lives in such and such town, you should drop in on her. And then even that is enough for that person to, you know, come and meet you at the railway station at 3 a.m. and bring you into their home and feed you. And, you know, Russians can be extremely warm, extremely generous people. And I think that that is a notion that, you know, most Americans don't have about Russians.
We're going to get into it in more depth. But before we even do that, I wanted to ask you this question. And that is, the pall of Soviet Russia, still hangover, still the cloud, still in so many people's DNA almost, and all the revolution and everything else. Would you say that that's there?
Well, I would say that, you know, to understand who Russians are today, you have to really understand what their history has been. And particularly for anybody who was alive today, you know, there's nobody, you know, everybody was either born during the Soviet era or after the Soviet era. And, you know, if you look at the history of the Soviet era, you know, one of the things that I did on this trip, you know, these three trips in 1995, I ended up being able to interview five generations of one family. And they told me about, you know, the Russian 20th century, essentially. So the eldest was the great, great grandmother of the clan. She was 98 years old. And she told me all about what it was like to grow up in Tsarist Russia. And what it was like to get married. She got married very young, and she, saw, you know, sent her husband off to war. He went off and fought in the First World War, and then he came back, and then it was the Civil War. And then once all of that had gotten straightened out, then you have Bolshevism, and you have the beginnings of the Soviet Union, and then you have, you know, some terrible hardships with the collectivization, and particularly in Ukraine, there was a lot of hunger, and then you have Stalin, and then you have the purges, and then right on the heels of that, you have the Second World War. And it's just this litany of hardships and litany of difficult things that people had gone through. And so I think to fully understand, you know, Russians and how they approach the world, and again, it's tough to generalize about an entire people, but if we're going to do it, you know, you have to really understand what they have come through as a people and what they've been through to understand, you know, how they are now.
The reservation that's kind of built into their personality, so to speak. So I did say it in the intro, but for those who are just coming into the show right now, I want to make the point. Lisa went three times over a 20-year period to Russia, saw so many changes. Second visit was one, and this wonderful book that she's written, Bears in the Streets, is about really, really it's a compilation, but it's more about the last time that she was there in 2015. And here's the deal. First, let's get to that crazy title. I love the title. What a great title of the book. Tell everybody why it's called Bears in the Street. Fabulous.
Yeah, so the reason I titled it Bears in the Streets was I wasn't sure what the title was going to be. And then on this third trip, and I should just sort of clarify that, you know, it's the trips themselves were to the same 11 cities each time and interviewing the same people each time. And so, you know, I've been talking, basically interviewing the same people for a period of 20 years. And so I went in 2015, I got to Vladivostok, which is where, you know, each of the three trips has started. And on the second day, this woman says to me, well, you know, Americans all just think we have bears wandering around in the streets here, which I thought was really, you know, kind of amusing. Like, it's a funny image. And I said, well, you know, I don't really think we think that, but I'll, you know, I take your point. And I kind of forgot about it. And then a week later, I was in a different city and another person said it to me. And a week after that, in a different city, another person said it to me. And by the end, I'd had five or six people in different cities say almost the exact same phrase to me. And so I started, I hadn't really heard people say this before in all the years I've been spending there. And I've been going to Russia since 1988. So I've been going there for almost 30 years. And so I thought, well, what does this really mean? Like, what's behind this? And the thing that I came up with that I think is what's behind it is it's Russians basically saying, you think we're backward. You think that we're like this sort of rural society that doesn't, you know our elbow from our whatever. And I think that the reason that comes about is, you know, there's Russians feel like during the Soviet era, there were two superpowers in the world. There was the United States and there was the USSR. And after the USSR collapsed, you know, you had this period of Russian history in the 90s where it was really chaotic and the economy collapsed and people were really suffering. And the United States kind of stopped caring about what Russia thought about anything because, you know, we perceived them as no longer a superpower and a weakened country, which they were. And so now, as particularly with Putin in power, one of the things I think Russians really like about him, at least the ones who talked to me, was that he's making Russia important again. Like, people are certainly paying attention to what Russia is doing right now. I mean, we talk about Russia in the news all the time now. And so the whole bears in the streets thing to me was just the Russians sort of saying, you know what? You guys think this, but you know, you're going to pay attention and we're important again.
Important that they need to feel important. That's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that?
I mean, that's what it seemed to me. I mean, anybody would, right? Like if all of a sudden, you know, the United States had some sort of crippling thing happen to our economy and all of a sudden we're not a superpower and we're not, I mean, I don't know. I tend to think Americans would feel the same thing.
I don't know. Right now I get the feeling that a lot of Americans wish we would just pull the hell out of the world, you know, today. Yeah. In fact, he was talking about NATO, you know, pay your bills, we'll stay there, but only if
right.
You know, it's interesting to me, they get no respect. Maybe that's what Russians are saying. We just haven't gotten a whole lot of world respect, and Putin's bringing us back into respect.
That was definitely my impression.
That's fascinating. So they don't see him as the evildoer.
Oh, no, not at all. No, most Russians do not. And look, I'll differentiate between, I think in Moscow and St. Petersburg, you know, for Russia, it's just like, you know, New York, D.C. here is not necessarily like the rest of the country. I think Moscow and St. Petersburg are their own things. But in the rest of the country, all these other cities and towns that I went to, you know, absolutely people saw Putin as, you know, they really liked him. They admired him. They had framed photos of him in their houses. They really were very pro-Putin. And I think, you know, for two reasons. One is, look, he came in on the heels of this super chaotic era with Boris Yeltsin, and he kind of restored order, and he made, you know, the economy got better, and whether that was his doing or not is another matter. That's above my pay grade. But the price of oil went up, the economy got better, people were doing better. And I think they tended to think, all right, Putin's in charge now and things are getting better. But the second thing that's happened, and it's very important to note this, is he very systematically shut down a lot of the opposition journalism in Russia. And so, you know, if you're a Russian person out in the hinterlands and you're watching Russian television, you're essentially seeing state-approved TV news. And so what they see is a lot of Putin's done this good thing and that good thing. And, you know, P.S., the United States and Western Europe are doing this horrible thing that we don't like. So there's a lot of that. It tends to be very monolithic, their television news.
So knowing that, do they know that their news is monolithic?
I think that some people do and a lot of people don't. And even people who've traveled abroad and are relatively sophisticated do not in some cases. I mean, I had a very contentious lunch with a woman, one woman in Chelyabinsk, a woman in her 30s who traveled abroad a lot. And she's very smart and she reads a lot, and she basically said to me, well, I hope you know that the Russian press is more free than the American press. And she truly believed it, you know, and I obviously don't believe that, you know, but sitting at this lunch where she's saying, no, it is, and I'm saying, no, it isn't. And, you know, like, where do you go with that? Like, where do you go from there?
So two questions that makes me ask. One is, nationalism is very strong in that nation.
Yes.
Okay. That always interests me. And the other is politics. I want to go there. Do they play politics like we are obsessed in America with politics? I mean, that what else is there now? Nothing.
Right.
Everything is
politics. So to your first question about nationalism, I mean, certainly Russians are feeling pro-Russia very intensely for the most part right now. A lot of the people that I met, you know, there's a popular line of clothes that has in big letters across the front. It's, you know, red, white, and blue stuff because that's also the colors of their flag. You know, it says Russia across it. And, you know, we and other Western nations imposed sanctions on Russia after everything was happening in Crimea. And that was a super galvanizing event for Russians. They felt like, okay, you guys want to impose sanctions on us? All right, you're going to see. Like, we're not going to. Speaking of bears, there was a popular bumper sticker where it was a bear sharpening his claws with a nail file, a big nail file, and across the nail file was written sanctions. So they're basically like, oh, you want to see, you know, you think these sanctions are going to hurt us? No. And they really galvanized Russians. So that speaks to the nationalism thing. With regards to politics, I don't think you can really compare the way that we in the United States are really fixated on our political game in the same way, because I feel like we as a nation are really divided, like, right down the center. It's really stunning to me how equal the numbers seem to be in terms of who is staunchly Democrat and who is staunchly Republican. And there's not the same kind of thing there. You know, the opposition journalism has been shut down. There's not tons in terms of, you know, very vocal opposition politics and politicians. And so, you know, for that reason, I don't really think you see the same level of engagement on that in that way as you have here.
Interesting to me. In the very beginning of the book, you talk of going back for the third time to meet the lighthouse keepers. I tell you, this is riveting stuff. Amazing to see how she progressed. Okay, it's Vasily and his wife, Valya. Tell us about them first. And I'm going to tell you why I really wanted to discuss this right now in a second, but tell us about them.
Okay. So when I, on the first trip, I went with this photographer named Gary Matoso, and Gary had designed this trip. It was his idea. And he said, I want to do this black and white photo essay, and I want to start with this remote lighthouse way down in the corner of Russia, southeast corner of Russia, right next to, like, 40 miles, literally 40 miles from North Korea, very close to China. And he said, I want to go to this lighthouse that he'd either read about it or seen a picture, so let's go there. So that was our first stop. We, like, find our way down to this lighthouse, and then there's a little house that sits nearby, and we're like, all right, we're going to go knock on the door of this house and try to meet these people. So Vasily was the husband, and Valentina, or Valya, was the wife. And, you know, Vasily was like, come on in. Hey, we're happy you're here. Have a meal. Let's have some vodka. Let's chat. And Valentina was really nervous. She was like, okay, this is not okay that these two Americans have just showed up here. And what it was two things. One is, you know, Vladivostok, until the collapse of the Soviet Union, was a closed city. It was a military city, and foreigners were not allowed to come. So this is only 4 years since Vladivostok had become open to foreigners at all. And the lighthouse was technically a military installation. They were employees of the Ministry of Defense. And so, you know, while her husband's all like, come on in, let's have a meal, she's like, whoa, 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 wait a second, roll back tape. And she was very nervous about it. But she also is a naturally friendly person, and she overcame her fears and decided that Gary and I were okay. And we ended up spending a few days with them, and it was really great. And then when I went back in 2005, I actually went with a different photographer, a guy named David. And I literally just showed up at their house again 10 years later, almost to the day, and like knocked on the door and was like, hey guys, how you doing? It's me again, you know. And at that point, Valya almost immediately said to me, oh my gosh, I'm so glad you're here. I don't know what was wrong with me before. It was totally fine. Take all the pictures you want. I'm so happy to see you. So that was really a very big turnaround for her. And then of course the third time I did the same thing. I literally just came and like knocked on the door again. And this time, you know, in 2005 they were a little bit like, what are you doing back here? And then this time they were like, hey, it's you again. And Bali even said to me, I was just thinking of you yesterday. And I said, oh my gosh, were you thinking like it had been 10 years and maybe I would show up? And she said, no, I just happened to think of you, which was really funny. So apparently I'm the only one so obsessed with this like 10 years, 20 years thing.
It was poignant to me when I was reading the story. Absolutely poignant. I mean, it actually brought tears to my eyes, because to see how not only as people, how they changed as times changed in Russia, but also you became friends, because time makes people friends. If you extend a relationship, oh, you know what I'm saying? So it was wonderful. But the pink blouse and the pink lipstick. Okay, the detail. Talk about that a little bit. It's just charming.
She just was like, you know, she came. I saw them at the lighthouse and everything, and we had a great reunion. It was so fantastic. I said, we'll go and hang out with you more. Let's make a plan. And then we made a plan. We met, actually, there's a big statue of Vladimir Lenin in Vladivostok, which was not far from the hotel where I was staying. And so we made a plan to meet at this statue, and we go and we meet at the statue. And she's wearing these little petal pusher pants and this pink blouse and this pink hat. And she just looks so like jolly and summery and just fantastic. And I was like, wow, it's so good to see you. And like, it was the first time I'd ever seen her not at the lighthouse. And it just was like, we just went wandering around Vladivostok and had a, you know, had a grand old time just taking in the sights, you know? And it really was. And to your point earlier that you made, I think it's absolutely true. Knowing people over a length of time, even if you haven't, you know, I haven't spent that many hours of my life with these people that I've seen on these three trips, but I got to know them when I was in my late 20s. And I think that did add something to, you know, I don't see them much. I see them every 10 years. But the fact that when we first met, you know, it was 20 years ago, I think that actually does make a difference. It really does. It just, you just feel, I don't know, you feel somehow closer to people.
There's a connection, literally, yeah, that occurs, and seeing each other after the time and seeing how you've aged and how you've changed, yeah, and what's happened in your life versus that. I don't know, it brings people together. You know, the reason that was interesting to me was because, you know, a lot of people could say, Russia. Who wants to spend three trips in Russia? I mean, you know, I'd rather go to, you know, Bermuda or whatever. Yeah. You love that country. And it's so clear that you love,
yeah,
that. But what?
I do.
I know,
yeah,
you do. And, you know, a lot of people would kind of roll their eyes and go, come on, Russia. But it's the people, isn't it? Because that's what I got from you.
It really is the people. And I'll tell you to that a funny story. So, you know, in between the first two trips, I wasn't in touch with anybody in between because pretty much nobody had email. And, you know, I didn't think I was ever going to see them again. And then in between the second and third trip, you know, I started, you know, there were a few people that I had their email addresses and, you know, maybe we'd be in touch with a little bit, not really. A couple of them I became Facebook friends with, but I'll tell you now I'm Facebook friends with almost all of them, which is just fantastic because we can continue to keep up with each other, which is really a lot of fun. But I got I was emailing with one of the women who I really love on the trip, and she sent me these two pictures in an email a couple months ago. One of them was her great niece had just had twins, and she sent me a picture, and it was this posed picture. It was like if you get a photographer in and you have the whole, and there were these tiny, tiny little twins. They couldn't have been more than about 5 or 6 days old, posed in essentially a nest. It was like a nest that had been made with these like little ribbons and stuff. And it was like, it was the most adorable thing. So she sent me that. And then also in that same email, she sent me a picture. She said, oh yeah, P.S. we got a new kitten. And then she sent me this photo of this giant dog that they have with this tiny little fur ball of a kitten. And I live in Los Angeles and I was out front that night and I get this email and I'm like, oh my God, you guys, look, my friend sent me this picture of her, like, you know, her niece's twins and her whatever. And I show them and they looked at me like, they're like, one of them actually said, this is not how I pictured Russian people.
Exactly. And totally.
Yeah.
Interesting part of the book. And I love this part of the book. And I love the fact that you were so honest about this. You're gay.
Yeah.
Now you're in Russia.
And, you know, yes.
You know, in the United States, there are some issues still going on with that, of which you point out, which are pretty good pictures. Your thing about it's easier to be a woman and come out as gay than it is to be a man, things like that.
Yes.
In the footnotes, which I loved. But there you were in Russia, which, you know, who knows where, because they live in a different culture, how they were going to respond, and you not being married. And then you,
yes,
talk to us a little bit about that, because,
yeah,
I thought that was wonderful.
You know, the first trip that I did, you know, I was 28. People would say, oh, are you married? Do you have kids? And I would say no. And then I'd think, all right, I'm not going to tell. I'm certainly not going to tell them I'm gay. It's 1995. That feels crazy. And, you know, I'm not going to do that. And so, you know, the next trip, now I'm 38. They ask if I'm married. I'm still not married. But I realized that now people are going to start to get worried about me. You know, here's this poor American woman who keeps coming back and forth to Russia, and she can't seem to get herself a man. And then the third trip, you know, I am married now. I've been married for 6 years. I was very reluctant to hide it or lie about it. And so, you know, I kind of made up my mind. Oh, and the other sort of funny thing is, you know, in the Russian language, you don't say I'm married in the same way we do in English. You either say I'm wifed or I'm husbanded.
I couldn't believe that.
Wow. So, yeah, just, and I realized this just before I went on the trip, and I thought, oh man, like I can't even sort of fake it and say, yeah, I'm married, but I don't want to talk about it. So that took away one of my like plans that I had. But so I just made up my mind. I really didn't want to lie about it, and I didn't want to hide it. And so, you know, I didn't come out to everybody on the trip, but I came out to a lot of them. I came out to a lot of them. And, you know, it's not illegal to be gay in Russia right now. It is illegal to propagandize your being gay to minors. And that can mean just about anything. That can mean whatever police essentially or the government wants it to mean. And so it's not a good law. It's very, very bad. Mm. It's very scary to be a gay person going across the country telling people. But the thing that I heard most often from people when I told them, and again, these are people who'd known me for 20 years, you know, it wasn't me going up to people on the street. But the thing that I heard most often from people was, I'm fine with it, but don't tell anybody else.
I like that. I like that a lot. It's movement. And it brings me to the next question, which is generations. Because this younger generation that's coming up, brought up in a whole different world, more accepting, more international.
I think so. Yeah. I think so. I think it's similar probably the world over. You know, I think, you know, young people today in Russia, in the United States, you know, pretty much anywhere, except for maybe North Korea, you know, you see depictions of gay people, or you see depictions of transgender people, or you see, you know, alternative lifestyles, for lack of a better term, in pop culture a lot, you know, and it's really, I think when you grow up with that, it can't help but change, you know, affect how you perceive the world around you. And I do think for the most part, you know, there are a lot of young people all over the world, I think, who are much less concerned about that kind of thing than generations previous were.
Another point very quickly that I did want to make, and because if you're in Moscow or you're in any of the big cities, there is a European flavor to it that I think most Americans aren't aware of. I think they think of the woman with the shmata on her head and the rural woman. It is a very cosmopolitan place in places, correct?
It definitely is, and you know, definitely, especially now. Boy, I was in Moscow this time. I would say, like, you know, Moscow, the first time I went in, you know, 1988-89, it was this very Soviet kind of gray place. When I went in 1995, it felt really chaotic. It felt, you know, just, you know, economically just really sort of not doing well. And then in 2005, it kind of felt to me, and I think I say this in the book, said something like, you know, it feels like that guy in high school who now has enough money to buy himself a fancy Corvette, but it kind of smacks of desperation. You know, like, it's a nice car in theory, but you're like, really, dude? And that's what Moscow kind of felt like to me in 2005. But boy, Moscow 2015, that is a cosmopolitan city. Like, that is a European capital. You know, they have free Wi-Fi in the metro, and they have bike lanes, and they have, you know, bike sharing. And I don't think these are things that people typically think about with Russia. But it is really, there are parts of it, there are neighborhoods of it that are just, I mean, it's just so beautifully spruced up, and it's just really, it's really something. It's quite impressive.
Everybody I know who ever goes there on assignment doesn't ever want to leave. So there must be something to, you know, something very special flavor there. Lisa, this is a travelogue plus a memoir. The 20 years of your life, your whole entire adult existence really wraps around this place that a lot of people are scared to death of. So my last question, I want to know, how has all of this changed, Lisa?
How has it all changed me?
Yeah. This has had to have
a great question.
An amazing effect.
Yeah. Well, that's a great question. You know, I think all of this started for me, you know, with that thing my mom did when I was 9, and me trying to get my head around the notion that, you know, regardless of what is going on between our governments, they're people and my mom's a person and they managed to get along. And one of the things that really struck me on this third trip, because, you know, there is a lot of anti-American sentiment right now in Russia, just as there's a lot of anti-Russian sentiment right now in America. And one of the things that really struck me is, you know, a lot of the people that I talked to as I was on this trip would say things about how, well, we don't like what the American government is doing. They really didn't like Barack Obama. They really were just, you know, they would try to make me understand, we really don't like all of these things, but we are so happy you're here. And we really like you, and we want you to always feel welcome here. And it was almost brought it full circle for me, because I thought, you know, this is what my mom came home and said. Yeah, maybe our governments don't get along, but they're really welcoming, and I was really happy to go spend time with them. And I guess if there's anything that I would like for this book to do, it's to say, you know, Vladimir Putin is one guy, and then there's 140 plus million other Russians, and a lot of them are really worth getting to know. And, you know, in the end, as much as we can just have the people to people, I think it's really helpful.
My line, exactly. I always say, leave the politicians out of the equation and the world would be a whole better place.
Now true.
I've been speaking with Lisa Dickey, author of Bears in the Streets, Three Journeys Across a Changing Russia. For more information about Lisa and her book, visit lisadickey.com. You are listening to the Hallie Kester Jane Show. My guests today are Lisa Dickey, author of Bears in the Streets, Three Journeys Across a Changing Russia, and adventurer Jeremy Cage, author of All Dreams on Deck, Charting the Course for Your Life and Work. Tune in to the Hallie Kester Jane Show at HallieKesterJane.com. Dreams are the most powerful force on our planet, and yet they are simultaneously incredibly vulnerable. So says entrepreneur, former Fortune 100 executive, and president of the Cage Group, Jeremy Cage, a man who had a dream to sail around the world, and he did. With his wife and their two children, the Cage family spent 16 months on their life-changing voyage. An expert in turning dreams into reality, since returning, Cage has become an advisor to thousands of people, showing them how to fulfill their dreams for their businesses and for themselves. Basing his advice on his years of corporate success, as well as his around-the-world sailing adventure, Cage uses a boat metaphor to articulate his process in his book, All Dreams on Deck, an inspiring, practical, and enjoyable guide to making work and personal dreams come true. Let's talk. Jeremy, All Dreams on Deck, Charting the Course for Your Life and Work. Great. I can't wait to get into the weeds with you. But before we go into the weeds, I'm interested in who you are. Who is Jeremy Cage? Who, the master of realizing one's dream, born, raised, where, what kind of childhood? I think, the preamble. Let's hear it.
So I'm English originally. I'm now a U.S. citizen, have been for a while, but I'm English originally, moved all around Europe as a kid. I majored in French painting and sculpture in college, and of course went straight from that into a career at Procter & Gamble. And I worked in Procter & Gamble internationally. I've had the blessing of being able to work and live in many different places around the world. So I was in Baltimore when we acquired a company there, then moved to Stockholm, Sweden for a while, London, then Caracas, Venezuela for 4 years, then down to Sao Paulo, Brazil. Then back up to the U.S. before going down to Mexico for 5 years to run PepsiCo's snack business down there. And then I took a sabbatical to sail around the world, a year and a half. We took our kids out of school. My son was 12 and my daughter was 10.
All right, well, I'm going to slow you down. I'm going to stop you there because before I get into that, and we're going to get into that, but I really want to know this. Were you a dreamer as a kid?
Always, yes. Yeah, I've always been an optimist and a dreamer, but yes.
An optimist and a dreamer. Okay, those are two important words that go together. Talk to me about that.
Well, I actually, as I talk about in the book, I think that actually dreams are the most powerful force on the planet. If you think about this country, if you think about every company, every brand, every service, every relationship, they all started as a dream. And we started actually physically as human beings as a dream in our parents' eyes of having children. So I think that dreams are the most powerful force on the planet, and I just don't think that we give them enough priority.
I absolutely agree with you there. Were you always so focused, though? And is that something that was instilled in you as a child?
No, actually, I had the benefit of having a couple of really great mentors when I was going both through college and through the early part of my career. In college, there was a fabulous professor. His name was Dr. Strawn, and he really gave me some great advice on, you know, focus on doing what you love and the rest will take care of itself. And, you know, I got that advice and I guess I was lucky enough or I don't know, courageous enough to follow the advice. And that's when I switched majors to what I really love doing. And seems like the rest has worked out so far, you know, pretty well so far. And then I had a great mentor. His name was Kevin Hall when I first started at Procter & Gamble. And he was the first one to challenge me to get really serious about my dreams.
The line that you just used, do what you love. You really believe that? I hear that a lot. I was just going to say, because that's a sentence that I hear a lot. I certainly believe it. I do with that. But is it just a sentence or is it something more real?
Well, I think it can be just a sentence if you leave it at that. But if you really take it to heart and you figure out what that really looks like and you get really specific about it and really intentional about it, then I think that you can absolutely do what you love. You just gotta be able to, I think, clearly articulate what that is and not use vague generalities.
Doer and dreamer. right? Together. That's a rare combination, by the way. I think the ones who get to the top are the ones who have both of those abilities. Is that something also that comes from a childhood? Can we teach that to our children? Can we impart that to our children?
Well, I think we can. I'm not going to be able to solve all of the world's problems at the moment, but I think if we step back and we look at ourselves and we say, I think that the reason why most of us actually don't achieve our full potential, or, you know, if you look at it a little bit more pessimistically, we die full of potential, is because we dream vaguely and we dread specifically. So we have a vague dream of what this or that looks like, what success in this or that looks like. And because it's vague, all of the obstacles or fears or dreads get in the way of us ever being able to achieve those dreams. So if we'd have said one day we want to sail around the world with our kids, it would never have happened, because what about the finances? What about the danger? What about this, that, and the other? Instead, my wife and I said, well, look, we really want to do this. We want to go when the kids are old enough to be able to remember it, to be able to help, to be shaped by it, but still young enough that it's okay to be with mom and dad, and we don't mess up high school. And so for those of your listeners who have kids, you know, that's a pretty short window. So we said, okay, so we need to go when Bradley is 12 and Elena is 10, which means we need to set sail in 2007. So what do we need to do to make that happen? You know, so we probably need a boat. We probably need to have, you know, like, have trained ourselves on how to operate the boat and got all the preparations in place. So you see what I'm saying? That's the difference. When you get really specific about the dream, then all of a sudden you just deal with the fears and the dreads and the obstacles one by one, and you just kind of get them out of the way because you're so focused on a very specific dream.
Okay, I'm going to get down to the weeds a little bit, because I want to talk to you about the dreaming part of it and how you made it come to fruition and how we all can learn to do that through some of the tools that we'll talk about. But in terms of you, because I'm fascinated by this, right? Because not everybody I know just stops everything and says, excuse me, I'm going to take my children and my wife and we're going to set sail around the world.
That's right.
I mean, okay. So that right there, that's pretty awesome. And I'm madly in love with you just over that. I mean, I just think that's just delicious. But here's the deal. What kind of a boat? You know, why did your wife agree to go on board? Was it harrowing? Was it everything that you dreamed it was going to be? Those things are important in the scheme of it all. Let's just spend a little time on all those things.
Okay. So the boat, it was a 43-foot catamaran, which means it's got two hulls instead of one. My wife and I, when we first got married, we did an exercise, again, a dreaming exercise, where we went into separate rooms. She wrote down all of the dreams that she has, both big and small. So I don't want any of your listeners to think that this is all about just huge dreams. Like, what are all your dreams, big and small? She did that list. I did it in a separate room. And then, still separate, we prioritized our most important dreams on each of our lists. And then we got together. And by the way, it's an exercise that I would highly recommend, because I guarantee you'll learn something about your partner or your spouse that you didn't know before. And, you know, high on my list was to sail around the world, and high on my wife's list was to travel the world. And we said, okay, let's do that one. That's a life kind of project for us to do together, a life dream for us to strive for together. And so, you know, then we just got on with it. We said, okay, so when do we want to go? How are we going to go? We needed to focus on building our skills. But yes, it was an incredible adventure. We started in the Mediterranean, did a big loop of the Mediterranean all the way east to Egypt. And then from Egypt, we started sailing west, went back through the Mediterranean, across the Atlantic, through the Caribbean and the north coast of Latin America, through the Panama Canal, over to the Galapagos, and then from the Galapagos across the Pacific to the islands of the South Pacific. And we spent about 5 or 6 months wandering through the islands of the South Pacific before we got to Australia, which is where we finished.
Was the reality as good as the dream?
Oh, better.
Really?
Yeah, it was incredible.
So here's the thing also. I mean, was it scary? And you know, you can see why I want to go there with you, because I think a lot of people may dare to dream. We're going to talk in a minute about the fear and what keeps you from fulfilling your dreams. But but in the midst of fulfilling a dream, is it scary sometimes? You go, oh my gosh, we went, you know, the weather gets bad, and you go, oh my God, why did I, am I, what are we doing here? I mean, did any of that kind of stuff happen?
Well, we did get, you know, we got caught between New Caledonia and Australia. We got caught in a very low grade hurricane for 3 days straight. So that was not particularly fun, but we never questioned why we were doing it, you know? So, and I do think that oftentimes, especially the bigger ones, your dreams involve risk. But I actually think that the bigger risk is actually not pursuing them, because you don't want to be at the end of your life looking at, you know, looking back on all of your woulda, coulda, shouldas. So I actually think that we don't, you know, place enough emphasis on the risk of not going for our dreams as much as we do on the risk of pursuing the dreams.
I'm so with you there. And I always say life is to be gulped, not sipped.
You got it.
Right? There ain't no point in going through it unless you play it that way. That's my whole feeling on it. So what are the point of dreams? You know, Freud thought dreams were about fulfillment. And you?
Well, I think it's about unleashing your full potential as you define it for yourself, not as others define it for you. I think it's figuring out, you know, like, so people know what's in their heart. They know what they're capable of doing. And it's not, you know, we're not all, you know, the Steve Jobs of the world. So, I mean, but he knew exactly what his full potential was, and he just kept living into it. And there are plenty of examples of those kind of individuals. We know what we really know what kind of potential we have inside ourselves. And it's all about trying to unleash as much of that as possible as you go through your life. So I think that the power of dreams is. Well, it's transformational, but it's also, what's the right word? I think it's just, you know, really empowering. And as I said, I think that, you know, going back to what I said earlier, I think dreams are the most powerful force on the planet. Everything around us, we're surrounded by everything that started as a dream. And yet the amount of time we dedicate as individuals to really thinking through that and being planful and intentional about our dreams, I don't think is near enough.
So talk to me about this. Dreams, are they an art, a science, a creative feat?
Oh, I think they can be. I think they can be all of the above, and I'm not trying to evade the question.
No,
but I think it depends. I think it depends on the individual. And what I talk about in the book is obviously just having a dream isn't enough. I mean, I would submit that that's a big first step. But then the second sort of area that I talk about is this, what I call the ladder of intentionality. So you need to get your specific dream, and the book that I've written, I've got a workbook in the back to help people sort through this. But then you've got to climb the ladder of intentionality. And the higher you go on that ladder of intentionality, it increases the likelihood that you're actually going to be able to achieve the dream. So lowest rung would be just thinking about something where you have the thought and it comes and goes and no one's the wiser. The next rung up would be to actually write it down, because then someone could actually hold you accountable. And that person could be you, by the way, hold yourself accountable to the dream. I think the next rung up is to declare something out loud, because now you're actually, it's your word. So you're declaring it out loud. And then I think the highest rung is when you've declared it in such a way that that everybody's talking about it. And all of a sudden what you've done is you've actually created a community of people that are there to help lift you up, to help you achieve that dream. That's when you're really at the highest level of intentionality behind your specific dream.
I think a lot of people dream. I think a lot of people are afraid to dream. We'll talk about that in a second. But I want to get to this point, and it may be a little bit negative, but I want to bring it in because I think it's reality, which is not everybody who has a dream can realize their dream. And why is that?
I'm not sure that I buy the premise.
Okay, that's fine. No, that's fair. That's fair. Go. Answer.
There are obviously, you know, people kind of going into depending upon what the dream is, you know, you may have some financial constraints. But if there are financial constraints, what is your dream for resolving those financial constraints? And how are you going to be specifically, like, you know, you hear a lot of people that say they want to retire early. Well, what does that actually mean? You are going to retire at what age? How much money are you going to need in the bank, you know, in order to support yourself from retirement till when you pass away? And so how much do you have in the bank now? How much do you need to be saving in order to get there? And then it's a binary decision. You're either going to change your behavior and save more, or you're going to change the dream, meaning you're going to have to shift, you know, like what early retirement means and looks like for you. So do you see what I'm saying? So if you get intentional about it and you start to put some specificity around the dream, then sure, you may need to adjust it. But all this time, you're really in the driver's seat. It's no one's telling you what it should be. So I don't buy the premise that dreams are unachievable. Obviously, not everyone could go to the moon. But if you really that if that's really your dream, you want to get to the moon, then what are you doing to train yourself to get into NASA, to train to be an astronaut, to actually be able to do it? You know, so
it's a step by step, sometimes tedious process to achieve the goal of getting to the dream.
Yeah, and I think the other, again, so now you, let's presume for a second, Hallie, that you've got your specific dream. And by the way, I think you should have dreams for all of the different components of your life. That's a separate conversation. Mm-hmm. But you have a specific dream. Now you're highly intentional about it. You've declared it in such a way that everybody's talking about it. Then comes the hard part, which is the planning and the preparation. What are you going to do to actually plan and prepare for that to happen? And this is where we often fall short. We don't think through, you know, what are all the things that we need to do? And, you know, for our sailing trip, I took marine diesel mechanics, you know, so we could be fully self-sufficient with our generators and our engines should we break down in the middle of the ocean. And my wife did marine medical training. She wasn't, you know, qualified to be a surgeon, but she was dangerous enough with a skin stapler. And she did abandoned ship training. We designed a navigation course for our kids who were young at the obviously pretty young at the time, so that if my wife and I were incapacitated or swept overboard, our kids could safely navigate and handle the boat. So there was a lot of planning and preparation that went into making the dream come to life. And that's where we often shortchange ourselves. And I think that's where a lot of dreams, quote unquote, die.
Here's something you say: work-life balance doesn't exist. Elaborate.
That's right. I think work-life balance is a gross oversimplification of us as human beings. I think, and it presupposes that work is 50% and life is 50%, and I just don't think it works that way. I talk in the book about this concept of the lifeboat, and in a lifeboat you have really important grab bags. So that's the stuff that you need to survive. And I think that if you look at life from a perspective that there is life balance, of which work is a really important part or one of the really important grab bags, and you need to have dreams for each of the different grab bags in your lifeboat, then that's, I think, a much healthier approach to living.
It's funny because, you know, people who like what they're doing, it is who they are, right?
That's right. But they also have other components. So like, for example, I think I have around 7 big buckets or 7 grab bags. You know, work is one for me, but also family is one. Fitness is another. Philanthropy is one. Financials, you know, like I want to be financially successful. That's another one. So I've got about, that's just 5, but I've got, I think, sort of 7 or 8. Really important things, and I have a dream for each one of those, and I don't want to ever make sure that if I'm in pursuit of my work dream, for example, that that's coming at the cost of my family or at the cost of my friends or whatever. And so it's, when you look at it across, when you look at life balance in that way, I think you can be much more intentional about making sure that you're leading a balanced life. And I think, you know, my perspective is I think that's healthier.
Well, certainly within the scope of this conversation, and the ship as being kind of the metaphor here, or the boat and the sailing, you know, keep the ship righted, keep it balanced. I mean, right?
You got it.
I mean, there you go. So you've had quite a career, I mean, but you aren't the poster child of climbing the corporate ladder and staying with one company forever. You've been very courageous in your career. You got to give you that, right? And I brought the word up courage before. I want to bring it up again. Courage versus fear. Some people are more courageous than others. Can we talk about that?
Yeah, my perspective is that courage is a muscle. And just like every muscle in your body, it can be exercised. And the more you exercise it, the stronger it gets. So again, going back to this idea, okay, if you've got your specific dream, you're intentional about it, and you've planned and prepared well, then you have to summon the courage to actually set physically and metaphorically set sail. And so I think that the steps that you take along the way all contribute to building that courage muscle, so that when you finally, you know, when you're finally ready to go or to make that big decision, you know, you're prepared to do it because you've been building that courage muscle. I think if we let it atrophy, then of course we're not going to have the courage, and we're not going to fulfill our full potential as defined by ourselves again, not as I'm defining it for you, because you just aren't going to achieve your dreams.
back to the metaphor, your ship, you control the rudder, right? I think when people, that empowers one if they remember that.
Yeah. And you know, what was interesting is the first night we'd done all of this preparation and everything like this. But the first night that we were setting sail to cross the Atlantic Ocean, 3,000 miles of open ocean, we were going to be at sea for 21 days without seeing land. We were scared to death. But then when we set sail out of the Galapagos, you know, like a year later, to sail across the Pacific to the islands of the South Pacific, it was a longer distance, a more dangerous ocean, but we were really calm and, you know, and confident because we knew we could do it because we'd summoned the courage first time to head across the Atlantic.
Jeremy, you talk about, and you mentioned it briefly, but I want to get into it, is tapping into potential. And you talked about your father-in-law. Could you expand on that a little bit?
Well, you know, my father-in-law was a wonderful man. I love him. And he was 90 when he passed away. And he was an engineering designer for engineering manuals and everything like that. So he did a lot of sketches. And, you know, he had a very long, successful life, great wife, great family, you know, nice house, you name it. But he showed me this sketchbook of his, and it had all of these things that he'd invented, basically, you know, throughout the course of his life, just that he'd thought about and he'd sketched down, like the snowboard and the windsurfer and all of these kind of things that someone else had actually then launched. You know, and it was almost his book of what I would call unrealized potential, you know, because he had all of these great ideas. He had all of these great dreams. He'd even, you know, written them down, but he hadn't done anything with them. And so I'm hoping that my book will challenge people not to have the same thing happen to them.
Let's talk intentions again, a little bit more depth. Is just focusing on your intent a good thing, an important thing? How powerful is that? You know, Oprah talks about intention too a lot. It's an interesting thing, this intention.
Yeah, no, I think you have to, I think intentionality is absolutely, you know, it's a critical driver and a critical enabler for us to achieve anything, right? And you can see it in people. You can see it in employees. You can see it in your siblings, or you can see it in your parents. You know, where is their intentionality behind actually either getting something done or accomplishing something? You know, I talk in the book about Michael Phelps. He had a very specific dream to become the most decorated Olympian of all time. He was highly intentional about that. He declared it in such a way that he got everybody talking about it. But then importantly, he also put in all the planning and preparation to enable and strategies and plans in place to enable him to actually achieve that dream. So intentionality, I think, is a key ingredient to making any of this happen. And again, it doesn't have to be a sail around the world kind of thing. It could be losing weight. It could be getting fitter. It could be having a better relationship with your son, daughter, spouse, father, mother, you name it. You got to approach it with a high degree of intentionality and declare it. Let people know that you're trying to repair your relationship with your son. And then you'll be amazed at you'll be amazed at how many people will help lift you up to achieve that dream.
Give me a little bit more on that, just in terms of this. What do you mean by intentionality? I know people are going to want to know more specifically what that really means.
Well, again, for me, you know, and I talk about this ladder of intentionality is, I think you're on the highest rung of the ladder of intentionality when you're actually declaring something out loud, but you're declaring it in such a way that you get other people actually talking about it. Did you hear Jeremy and Pat are talking about sailing around the world with their kids? That's amazing. Well, you know, you start getting this buzz around there, and then, you know, and all of a sudden you start to feel like responsible for, you're going to let them down as well as yourself down if you don't go for it. And, but equally you'll have them. What I found is that those folks will then also help lift you up and try and help you achieve what it is that you're trying to go for.
Let's stick with the sailing metaphor. There are times in life when you face a lot of headwinds. What then?
Well, there's always going to be exceptions. But my perspective is that I think that more often than not, you should adjust course, you know, adjust the sails, maybe, you know, shift your destination a little bit. But most of the time I find that the worst thing you can do is actually turn back and retreat. So you're gonna face adversity. If you understand clearly what dream it is that what your dream is and what your quote unquote destination looks like, you're gonna encounter the hurricanes that we encountered or the storms or this, that, and the other. You adjust the sails. You maybe shift course a little bit here and there. But but you keep going. And I think that's, you know, that requires, again, that requires courage. And the more you can kind of keep going in the small stuff in your life, the more you build that courage muscle so that when you're faced with the bigger challenges, you're prepared.
So with everything that you tell us in All Dreams on Deck, this just terrific book, it's a primer. Everybody should walk around with it. I mean, it's really...
I'm with you.
No, I'm sure you are, but it's really, really true. And the end of it is really terrific. I mean, it's that wonderful little workbook. It'll get you where you need to go. But out of everything that you said in that book, Jeremy, if you had to boil it down to one important thing, what would that be?
I'm going to sound a little bit repetitive, but I think that, well, actually there are two things. One, that dreams are the most powerful force on the planet, and that most of us will die full of potential because we dream vaguely and we dread specifically. So do your best to flip that on its head and dream specifically and dread vaguely, and I think you're well on your way.
Okay, one last thing. Are we ever too old to dream?
Absolutely not.
I love you.
No, absolutely not. I mean, you know, like, no, I think that, you know, the dreams may be slightly different, but I think that, and my intention here is to, if any of your listeners are just graduating from college, that this helps them chart the course for their life and work from the beginning. Equally, if you got someone who's stuck mid-career or just not feel, you know, just feeling like they're stuck in the mud, hopefully this just gives them the impetus to get unstuck. And similarly, folks who are just retiring, they've got a whole new, you know, a couple of decades or whatever left. What are their dreams for those decades and how do they go about making them happen?
Jeremy, I love you. You have to come back. No kidding. I love the positivity.
Well, thanks very much. I've never been accused of being a pessimist.
Good to have you here.
Yeah, well, thanks very much.
I've been speaking with Jeremy Cage, author of All Dreams on Deck, Charting the Course for Your Life and Work. For more information about Jeremy, his book, and his work at The Cage Group, visit thecagegroup.org. Thanks so much for tuning in to The Hallie-Kasser Jane Show, a production of Resec LLC. The Hallie-Kasser Jane Show posts new podcasts Wednesdays, 3 p.m. Eastern. Visit HallieKasserJane.com.